Call the House Judiciary Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, January 20th. For the first item on the agenda today is House Bill 2310. I have David Gannett and Sybil Hebb, please, if you'd like to come up. Everybody in the audience, if you turn off your phones and so on, Blackberries, because if you get a call, those interfere with the recording system. Proceed at either whoever wants to go first. Just identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chairman Barker. Members of the committee, I'm David Gannett. I am a private practice attorney specializing in family law for the last 16 years out of Portland, Oregon. But I'm testifying today in my capacity as chair of the legislative subcommittee of the family law section of the Oregon State Bar. We're the proposers of this bill, House Bill 2310 as well as 2311. Both bills have to do with modifying current statutory terms in Family Abuse Prevention Act restraining orders. House Bill 2310 has to do with modifications under subsection 730 of the ORS 107. Currently, the statute would allow a restraining order to be modified for parenting time schedule and for custody. As you can imagine, though, in a order having to do with parenting time, there are terms of place of drop-off, place of pickup, children's school, places of work, changes of addresses, changes of contact information. And under the statute, that is not permissible. It has been the OJD's information from the judges. We took the OJD's ideas. The judges are actually modifying restraining orders for practical reasons, but they don't have the statutory authority to do so. So we're asking for a modification that would enable the judges to address the terms that go around the times of custody and parenting. There has been work with the domestic violence community with feedback. Legislative Council has drafted a proposal that says that for good cause shown, terms regarding parenting time may be modified. We have had comments from the domestic violence community that they would like to see more specificity rather than the term good cause shown. I work with Ms. Hebb, and we do have language we are currently working on. That language would be an amendment to the bill. Obviously, we're in favor of that. What we're looking for is current protection or continued protection for the protected person in the restraining order so that there wouldn't be any opening for harassment. We're also looking at expediency, that if it's not contested, why there should be a hearing. If it's going to be something that the petitioner proposes and the respondent agrees to, then it should be easily done with the court without a hearing. We're looking at putting terms into the amendment for this bill that would then narrow the scope and allow expediency. I have no further comments.
Thank you. And when I glanced at the sign-up sheet, I saw two yeses, but I was looking at the wrong column. Okay. So I called you both up. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center. And I'm here today to echo Mr. Gannett's comments about the amendments that we're working on. I'll give you just a little bit of background. The Oregon Law Center, as many of you know, is a statewide nonprofit law firm. We provide free legal assistance to low-income Oregonians. Our mission is to achieve access to justice for the most vulnerable in our state. And as you can imagine, victims of domestic and sexual violence are incredibly vulnerable in our state, and the restraining order process by which they can seek protection from abuse is one of the most critical forms of relief for that population. So it's the FAPA, Family Abuse Prevention Act restraining order process, is one in which we have a lot of involvement. We represent victims in those proceedings, and we care a great deal about that statutory protection. we appreciate and understand that there are some circumstances in which the court's current inability statutorily to make modifications of some of the terms of restraining orders after the order becomes final can be a problem. Sometimes that's a problem for either party who may want to change an element of the protection rather than to have to dismiss the entire order, for example. And so it's something that we understand, but we want to be careful that the proposed bill does not turn into what we worry might become a tool for further harassment of the court system as well as of the victim in the proceeding. If there's no sort of limitation on the scope of the respondent's authority or ability to request amendment after amendment because he or she may continue to disagree about a particular provision that the court made, we think that that would have detrimental impact on the victim, the children, as well as the entire system. And so we've been very appreciative of the willingness of of Mr. Gannett and the bar to consider those concerns. We've got some good ideas moving about amendments. I think the district attorneys would need to be consulted as well, just to make sure that they don't have any concerns. And I spoke briefly with Gina Skinner, who is a representative of the district attorneys, via voicemail, and I think she's willing to participate in that process as well. So, thank you.
Are there any questions from the committee? Yes.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I don't care who answers this. You indicate, I think, Mr. Gannett, in your written testimony that you think and I'm going to 2311, we're talking about both of these bills, 2310, or we're just at 2310 right now?
Yes.
Okay. That's good. Then on 2310 in particular, I'm assuming that you'll work on, I understand the concern where you have sort of competing orders from the court, or you have a situation, I guess, where the FAPA is sort of preeminent and predominating the situation. I guess where I'm getting at is I want to make sure that we don't get into a situation where we're creating more of a problem than what we're trying to clear up, and that's my bottom line. So as you're working on some amendments and modification or proposed amendments to this, I guess I'd hope you'd keep that in mind. I mean, I've done this stuff for 18 years, and they can get really tricky. And I also know that a lot of these people, oftentimes are not represented, which is why I'm glad to hear you talk about getting the district attorneys involved, because I don't want it falling back on them to be representing people in a modification proceeding.
And I can speak to that. Thank you, Chair Barker and Vice Chair Stiegler and members of the committee. I did actually, I don't mean to speak for Ms. Skinner because, of course, she's not here, but we did discuss that particular issue. And, of course, these proceedings are civil proceedings. It's only the violations, you know, that would result. And so I think that that's something that that she's aware of and is reviewing the issue.
There's a perceptional thing there as well. I think a lot of the petitioners on these particular kinds of orders look at the state as their attorney, and I guess, you know, I want to steer us away from having folks who are involved in the criminal area doing some kind of, there's an expectation that they're going to advise a litigant with respect to what's essentially a civil issue. And again, the other thing is I understand that there may be a broader reason that you want to be able to modify some of these, but my experience is that as much as anything, I mean, if a divorce proceeding or some other domestic relations proceeding is instituted, most everything can be taken care of through that arena. And I guess I'm just need some clarification as to why you feel so strongly this is necessary. I just have grave reservations that this is going to be utilized. I mean, I've seen it happen, utilized as a tool for their harassment.
Chairman Barker, Vice Chair Stiegler, my experience has been when you've got a domestic relations case, be like a dissolution or a legal separation, let's use divorce for the most common, and you have a restraining order. Most counties, the practice is to consolidate the cases so you have one judge hearing both matters. If the domestic violence order comes post divorce judgment, then you have a supersession of the restraining order, because now you have a new event, the alleged abuse, that would then trump the terms of the judgment.
The domestic relations judgment.
That's right.
Yeah, right.
The modification is solely in the civil court, and yes, I know what you're talking about with a lot of protected people looking at it as a district attorney is going to enforce the terms of that judgment. They do look at the state as for keeping people accountable, which is one of the attributes of a domestic violence restraining order. As for the modifications, since we're dealing solely with 107.730, the court's jurisdiction, as Ms. Hebb said, was solely civil. I don't think a DA's office would be permitted. They're not a party of a civil proceeding in that situation. They haven't brought the charges for the violation. So I think it is centered back to solely the participants, protected person and the restrained person, and the judge. And that was some of the Ms. Hebb's concerns in terms of what we get on the amendments is that we're to subject matter specific, moving away from that very broad clause of for good cause shown to we're looking at
categorical kind of
actually items. What we're looking for is we went back into the statute and said what does the original restraining order subject matter restrain on, and why don't we repeat just one of those two points in the amendment so that we're consistent from when the order originated to when it's being modified.
Well, and again, I mean, the circumstances of most of these cases are such that you don't have people who are oftentimes represented. And my only issue with respect to the DAs is that the perception is they know that that's who enforces it, but they don't understand always clearly that that's it, that's all they do. But on the other hand, with respect to the actual modifications, I mean, I've had some of those clients in my lifetime who, it's an after-the-fact kind of thing, and they just really don't understand. Oftentimes, they're not representing the other side, maybe. So I just have some real concerns when you start tinkering with what's supposed to be a protective. I mean, there are just so many nuances in this area of the law. I mean, there's so many nuances with respect to the whys and wherefores and why these orders are, I mean, and I understand the abuses of the process and the system as well, but I really have grave concerns about making it more difficult to do what FAPAs were originally designed to do, which is protection.
And if I may, I'm assuming these are to take care of your ideas, to take care of things like if I was working as a job and suddenly either my shifts got changed or my days off got changed, that I'd be able to make a contact and have the court make an adjustment to visitation or something like that. Is that what we're trying to...
Chair Barker and Vice Chair Stiegler and members of the committee, I think that is the kind of thing that was contemplated by the proponents of the bill when it came forward. For example, if I, as a victim, found the need because of circumstances that arose after the restraining order was entered to add a term of restraint because I no longer wanted to have telephone contact from the respondent because that was proving to be abusive, then that would allow me the ability to add that protection this would allow that ability. Or, for example, to add or subtract an employer's address or a daycare address, that kind of thing. So that is the kind of narrowing scope that we've been talking about. I do think, though, that we do need to be very careful about the points that raised by Vice Chair Stiegler in that, in these relationships where a perpetrator is participating in a cycle of abuse, we see sort of escalating contacts, and the whole purpose of the restraining order is to put a stop to that. And so allowing modifications, I think we believe there's good cause to be concerned that could play into the hands and which would be completely contrary to the purpose of the existence of the order in the first place. And so that's what we're looking about. I think we're interested in investigating some examples of processes that individual courts have come up with to try to address this situation, and we'll look at that to see whether there are any good examples of local practices that might give us some guidance.
Okay. Further questions? Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate you working together to try and come up with an amendment to narrow this and make it work. Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2310. going to open a quick work session on House Bill 2399. This is for the purpose of referring House Bill 2399 to House Business and Labor Committee. And that's all we're doing, so I would entertain a motion to do that. I got my scripts in here.
Chairman Barker, I need a motion to refer.
That's me.
Okay.
I said that.
Okay, good. Representative Barker, I move to refer HB 2399 to House Business and Labor Committee with no recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Wisnant has moved House Bill 2399 to the Business and Labor Committee with no recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Excused.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Excused.
Vice Chair Stegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Why is it here?
Motion carries. The bill will be referred to the House Business and Labor Committee. Next item on the agenda is we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2311. And Mr. Gannett again, please.
Thank you, Chairman Barker, members of the committee. I'll just repeat again that I'm here in my capacity as the chair of the Legislative Committee at the subcommittee of the Family Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. Here are the proposals of this bill. This bill is to address a very particular problem under Family Abuse Prevention Act restraining orders. There's a prohibition of contact on the protected person. Contact, as described in ORS 163, means contact by a third party to the protected person. We have, in the 16 years of practice, we have basically turned away from our clients when represented protected people. When they get served, we don't tend to tell them to raise this as a served process, served a summons for a legal proceeding. We tend to say that even though there's the statute doesn't allow the contact, the other side does have the right to proceed with their legal rights, and that proper service is legitimate under the law, even though there's a conflict between the restraining order statute and the rules of civil procedure. I understand through OJD that actually someone was prosecuted for having legal service affected on a protected person by the district attorney's office. Given the rise of that problem, we think that it's appropriate that there should be an exception under the domestic violence law that service pursuant to the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure should be allowable, and that should not be considered a violation of contact on a protected person. That's the bill.
Okay, thank you. How would this... The same kind of concerns that came up last time that somebody would be trying to use this as a harassment tool? I guess with a legal document that would be coming out of the court to begin with.
Chairman Barker and members of the committee, what we see being served is a summons. So a summons be generated by that person or by that person's attorney, and then either a petition or a motion that would have been filed with the court. So you're looking at eventually having a court hearing on that subject matter. It would be a defense of the protected person to say this: there's no substance to this motion, this is frivolous, and it was done for purposes of harassment.
Thank you, Representative Steiger.
Yeah. Doesn't matter, I answer to them all. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gannett, 2311 is proposing a change in the service aspects of the of FAPA to go.
Chairman Barker, members of the committee, no, we're not saying anything about service. Service is done according to Oregon Rules Civil Procedure 7 and 9.
Right.
This is allowing for an exception for, there's a total prohibition on contact under a restraining order. This gives a caveat saying there can be contacted by a third party for the purposes of service.
Representative Barton. I'm sorry, were you done?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
So by way of question, Mr. Chair, thank you.
To the extent there have been courts that have held that initiation of legal process of any kind is barred by a restraining order, I understand the need to clarify in the statute through some way, because frankly, that's an astonishing holding. I think it has some due process problems, to say the least. However, my concern is that as worded, I have no trouble. We should certainly protect the right to initiate legal process and affect a service of a summons through ORCP 7 or 9. However, as worded, could say, for example, what if it's a pro se plaintiff? As worded, could they actually serve themselves? Would that? I don't want to create an exception. Yeah, they themselves serve the other party. Did that make sense?
Yeah. Chairman Barker, Representative Barton, members of the committee. Under ORCP 7 and 9, let's go with 7 first. 7 is personal service, and under ORCP 7, you cannot, if you're a party, you cannot personally serve. It has to be by a third party. You're not allowed to service. And for ORCP 9, it's by mail. So, short of educating a pro se that they have to get an intermediary to serve, that's a reading of the ORCPs. I don't think we want to put that in the statute.
That's what I mean.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Any further questions? Okay, thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2311. I'm going to briefly reopen work session on House Bill 2399 to allow Representative Cameron to vote on that. Representative Cameron, we referred House Bill 2399 to the House Business and Labor Committee with no recommendation.
Aye.
Thank you. We'll close the public hearing the work session on House Bill 2399. We'll open a hearing on House Bill 2306. Sybil Head and Carnes. Okay. You can proceed. Just please identify, any order you wish. Please identify yourself for the record.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Keith Carnes. I am here from the Oregon State Bar. I am the chair-elect of the Consumer Law Committee of the Oregon State Bar. I'm also an attorney who practices bankruptcy law in one of the longest and established and biggest law firms in practice in Oregon at Olson, Olson & Daines. We focus mostly on bankruptcy work as well as other consumer litigation issues. I'm a member of the National Consumer member of the National Association of Consumer Advocates and a member of the National Association of Consumer Bankruptcy Attorneys. I'm here though on behalf of the bar. This bill has some important issues, although they be small changes, are very important ones to people who find themselves in financial. People who find themselves in financial distress. We see an onslaught of bankruptcy being filed by individuals here in Oregon because of the financial climate. The federal law allows each state to decide whether debtors in bankruptcy are entitled to exempt assets under state law pursuant just to the regular judgment debtor exemptions, or the state has an option of letting the debtor choose either state or federal law. And federal law is very similar to state law in many aspects, but there is one significant difference. The federal law allows a debtor in bankruptcy to claim a one-half of their homestead exemption in personal property. Therefore, those who do not have homes can use one-half of the federal exemption, or $10,000, to protect things like tax refunds or a vehicle or something else in lieu of a home. And given the vast number of foreclosures that folks are facing now and the number of people who have been displaced out of their homes, this would allow them a fresh start holding on to some asset. Since they can't hold on to their home and they can't protect that asset, this bill would allow them to keep something to help them get the fresh start that they need. The reasons for this, I think, are a couple. First of all, many people in Oregon are already claiming federal exemptions. Under current federal bankruptcy law, the debtor claims the exemptions of the residence where they lived 2 or 2.5 years ago based on this convoluted rule that I won't take your time to explain now. Suffice it to say that all debtors claim the exemption of the state that they lived in between 2 and 2.5 years ago. So those folks who lived in California or Washington 2 or 2.5 years ago are claiming federal exemptions in Oregon today, while long-term residents and taxpayers are not able to. Other people, for instance, some states protect homesteads only in their state. They, for instance, in the Oregon Homestead Act, we only protect real estate in Oregon. We don't protect it in other states. And so under these circumstances in similar states, for instance, in Ohio, if a debtor were to move to Ohio, even though Ohio doesn't have federal exemptions, they could still claim the federal exemptions because that would leave their assets unprotected because Ohio says you can only protect assets in Ohio and not in Oregon. And so there's a large number of people who are already claiming these federal exemptions. And so as a matter of fairness, we believe that they should be able to do the same here. Lastly, to allow debtors to keep these small assets would protect the court's time to really ferret out true bankruptcy abuse. We see a lot of folks who will get their tax refund and spend it because their furnace breaks or their car breaks down and they need the money right away. And so the bankruptcy trustee, who has a fiduciary duty, has to pursue that debtor to go after them to recoup that money on behalf of the creditors. And when they don't pay it immediately, the trustee has a duty to file suit to seek to revoke the entire discharge from that debtor. Allowing the debtors to keep these small tax refunds in these cars will eliminate that whole process. I've also included a testimony of Mr. Richard Parker, who's an attorney in Portland. He's represented both debtors and creditors over time. And he points out that, you know, there's trustees who feel that their duty requires them to seek these small assets, even as little as $400 or $500. The trustee would take 25% as his or her commission, leaving these creditors to receive literally less than pennies on the dollar. And so this would help make the whole system more efficient and focus on the true bankruptcy abuse that can sometimes happen instead of wrangling over these small assets that, quite frankly, Bank of America may not want to check for $3 or $4 on a $10,000 or $15,000 debt. And so for those reasons, we think that, you know, this statute should be passed. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb again for the Oregon Law Center. We also urge your support of this bill for policy reasons. We don't practice bankruptcy law, so I'll leave the technical explanations to Mr. Carnes, but from a perspective of low-income Oregonians, I can tell you that in our offices across the street, we are seeing a rising tide in, it's no secret, this horrible economic time of clients who are struggling with debts, struggling to make payments with debts, increasingly driven to bankruptcy because they are unable to keep food on the table and also maintain their debts. And so we worry about those clients, and extending the same exemption protections to them as are available for individuals who have homes, we think is a fair public policy piece that will help Oregonians and their families maintain a little bit more stability through this rocky time. So thank you.
Thank you. I have a question. I've been contacted by people opposing this, and their position is, well, why should just the debtor, I mean, the law is the way it is now, and if you change that, then why not give us the choice of saying you get to use federal or state rather than the debtor? And I mean, I understand that, but so they feel it puts them at a disadvantage. I mean, I'm not familiar with bankruptcy law.
Well, the federal law only gives states the option of letting debtors claim the federal exemptions or the state exemptions or just the state exemptions. And so, you know, the as a practical matter, there really isn't a lot of difference. I attached here a copy of the 522 exemptions, which are those available under federal law, and the state exemptions. The dollar amounts are actually very similar. There are times where actually Oregon has more exemptions, and for instance, a single person filing bankruptcy in Oregon gets to protect $30,000 of equity in his or her home, but under the federal law, it's only $20,000. So there's times where the state laws are actually more generous than the federal law. Really, the only issue comes down to, is, as far as a big difference, is just that unused homestead for those who don't have a home. Otherwise, the creditors would be treated the same, essentially, as in both systems, under the state or federal exemptions. And so it's only protecting those who really don't have any other assets to protect. It's not a way for those who have assets to gain a greater advantage over creditors in the system. I hope that answers your question, Chair.
Yeah. Representative Barton.
A follow-up question to that. Now, concededly, there isn't a substantial difference right now at this time in the exemption amounts under federal and state law. However, and again, I don't practice this area of law whatsoever, but reading the statutes, the federal exemptions are indexed, whereas the state ones are not, according to my reading. That strikes me as a very, very big difference. Is that correct?
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, that is correct. The federal exemptions are tied to the Consumer Price Index. I believe right now they're probably going to be declining. And so, I mean, it's not going to be, you know, doing much change right now, if any. But traditionally, I do practice in Oregon and Washington. Washington does allow their residents to claim federal exemptions. Traditionally, they've been about similar. I mean, every so often, the committee here or the legislature generally will bump up the exemptions as time goes by, and we've seen that traditionally through the process here in Oregon. And they've been typically very close to the federal exemptions, but the federal ones are tied to the Consumer Price Index so that Congress doesn't have to
worry itself over these dollar amounts.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Markey.
Chair, members of the committee, Matt Markey representing the Oregon Collectors Association today. We do have some concerns with the bill, and I want to start off by apologizing. I thought that my attorney from our group is going to be joining me today, and I'm not an expert on bankruptcy law, so I apologize for that. Our committee, our association hasn't taken a formal position at this point, but in the past we've always had concerns about this. We haven't had a chance to review it yet since the session has just started. And while you did hear that Washington passed a very similar law, our attorney's first read at least, he was worried that the way this bill is drafted, that it would allow a debtor in this case to pick and choose between exemptions, state versus federal, and that is a great concern of ours. I'm also, Paul Cosgrove with the Financial League asked me to also put on the record for him that his group is opposed to this as well. We'd like to keep the dialogue open with the bar and see if we can come to some sort of an agreement that works for everybody, but at this point we do have concerns with the bill.
Would ask that you do that if you could, Mr. Markey, if you could work with the bar and see if you can't come up with some accommodation. I can see concerns that were mentioned. If it's indexed, that would.
Yeah, and there are differences between the two, and we just want to work through that.
And if you could have your people take a look at the Washington law and see where that's different. And
that will do so.
Okay, thank you. Yes, excuse me.
Hey, Mr. Markey, maybe you're not the person to answer this. Mr. Karn should have. I should have, but he sort of raised this question in my head. I'm assuming the proposal here, my reading of it was, you make an election one way or the other in its entirety. You don't get to cherry pick between the two schedules. Am I correct? Is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Stigler, I think that might be their intent. I don't want to speak for them. I think that might be their intent. I'm not sure that that's the way it's drafted.
That's the way I understood it, that it was one or the other.
That may be wrong. Yeah, if we're wrong.
Yeah, no further questions? Okay. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Markey, who are you representing in this?
The Oregon Collectors Association.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
there any further business to come before the committee today? Hearing none, meeting adjourned. I don't know if I should be.